Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, mystic psychologist and scientist, coming to you from Zero Point, an institute for mystical and spiritual science located outside of Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. I'd like to thank BBS Radio again for providing this service and the possibility for such alternate programming as my talks involve and the wide variety of inspired speakers and guests that they have through their programming. I have been with me here is James Moffat. Hi, James.
Hello.
How are you, Jim?
I'm cold. How are you?
Okay. Yeah, it's been cold. Cold period a bit.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you find time, Jim? I recommended you have a look at my website. Did you find any time to look at that?
Yeah, I did. I read your...
Good. Okay, so we'll come to that in a few minutes then.
Yeah.
The listener, my website is at www.zeropoint.ca. And I have a wide variety of writings up there, and I've been putting some new materials up lately as I've embarked on trying to provide some critical reviews of popular books and movies. Up there at the moment, I have a critique of What the Bleep Do We Know movie, and I've just put up a critique of Dean Radin's book called The Entangled Mind. Entangled Minds, sorry. But I'll come to that in a few moments. And I hope within the next few days to put up a critique of Down the Rabbit Hole and The Secret and Deepak Chopra's book, How to Know God, and other books which I think are really quite misleading in what is being promoted as New Age or New Thinking. I think there are fundamental mistakes being made. And I'll elaborate some of those today. The most fundamental of all stem from the issue as to the nature of human consciousness. Because in these movies, Down the Rabbit Hole and The Secret and so on, the primary assumption in these works is that human consciousness is produced by the brain or is centered in the head. And a human being is regarded as having one mind. We think we have a mind and a body. Okay. Now, in the mystical tradition, in a sense, Gurdjieff says we don't just have one mind. We really have seven minds, seven different aspects of our being. Each of those seven has a mind. So instead of having a dualistic view, as in modern thought, of a mind in the head attached to a body, mystical and spiritual teachings firstly elaborate that a human being is threefold. So you function mentally, emotionally, and physically. And each of those centers has a different center in your body, in yourself. The head brain is the intellectual center in the mind, the brain. The emotional center is the heart and also involves the autonomic nervous system. And then the physical self involves the body with its capacities for sensation and movement. So really a human being has a threefold nature, functioning mentally, emotionally, and physically. Now even after 100 years of pseudoscience, modern psychology has not yet got to the idea of the threefoldness of human beings. They still primarily define psychology as a science of behavior and the mind in the simplistic dual way. And we think, as I've been saying, that there's only one mind. In contrast, mystical teachings give us much more elaborate and subtle and complex models of the different faculties of the mind. From a mystical perspective, the deep mind is really within the heart. And I quote Guru Bawa, who says, "I studied psychology once, and I lost all my powers." I'm trying to find this quote. Psychologists think the mind is in the head. And that is... I usually remember this off the top of my head, but I've lost this quote, Jim.
Maybe you should look in your heart.
Okay, this is Guru Bawa. He says, "I studied psychology once and I became crazy. Bawa responded in a playful tone. I lost all my powers. Psychologists don't know where the mind is. Some think it's in the brain. Others think it's in the genitals. Others think it's in the ass. But the mind is in the heart, and that is what psychologists do not know. Unless the heart opens, you will be driven crazy by the monkeys of the mind. So that's a very immediate, direct statement that the deeper level of mind, or I would say also of consciousness and the self-experience, these things are associated with the heart, not with the mind and the brain in the head. But this concept that consciousness and mind are all up in the head, this has become the dominant kind of pseudoscientific viewpoint, as well as the viewpoint in many New Age materials, like in What the Bleep Do We Know, where there's no mention of the heart through the whole program or the soul, and it's assumed that consciousness is produced in the mind, although no one has any idea how or where or what it is. Recently, I'm just at the moment, I hope to post my newest review. It's of a book called How to Know God by Deepak Chopra. And I'd like to quote a few quotes from Dr. Chopra to illustrate what I mean. Okay, because he elaborates what I would call the head doctrine. And I'm stating that all the esoteric, spiritual, mystical teachings elaborate the heart doctrine, that the mysteries of human consciousness and existence have to do with the mysteries of the heart. And the true self is within the heart, and the mind in the head is more the center of the egoic self or the acquired personality nature. Mystics describe the process of self-realization as involving the dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. So in mystical traditions, the quest to know self has to do with the awakening of the heart. Okay, so here's some quotations from Dr. Deepak Chopra's book on how to know God. Now our search has narrowed down in a way that looks very promising. God's presence, his light, becomes real if we can translate it into a response of the brain, which I call the God response. We could get even more specific. Holy visions and revelations aren't random. They fall into seven definite events taking place inside the brain. Okay, so that's the beginning. He's saying our experience of God is all up in the brain. I've got different quotes of this. Okay, page 8 we'll go to. The mind is much more primary than the brain in creating all perception. Okay, that's related. But here Chopra identifies the mind exclusively as being in the head. Okay, so the brain with its seven basic responses provides more than sanity and meaning. It provides a whole world. Presiding over this self-created world is a God who embraces everything, but who also must fit into the brain's way of working. This is quite funny. So Mr. God's got to fit into the brain's way of working. Isn't that funny, Jim?
Yeah.
The problem of God's contagion. Mr. God's got to fit into the brain here.
You're reminding me why I couldn't finish that book. It's just awful. I started reading it, and it just seemed completely silly to me.
Yeah. It is. I'm going to go on because some of these quotations tie into what you and I have always called the problem of God's contracting universe concerning the issues of kind of science and religion. So here I'll continue on. As far as I know, the brain cannot register a deity outside the seven responses. Why not? Because God is woven into reality, and the brain knows reality in these limited ways. It may sound as though we're reducing the Almighty Father, that primeval goddess, and the mystery of mysteries to a firestorm of electrical activity in the cerebral cortex. But we aren't doing that. We're trying to find the basic facts that will make God possible, real, and useful. I think that's so funny. We're going to find the facts that are going to make God possible.
Well, I don't even get what he's saying there. Is he's he's saying that there's the seven basic responses, which I take it are in the brain, but then he's saying we're not reducing it to the brain's electrochemical process. It sounds exactly like what he's doing.
Well, he is, really. He does reduce it to the brain.
Good.
But he's also trying to say it's the brain, but the mind may not exactly be limited to the brain.
Okay.
Like he's leaving that other quote. He's kind of distinguishing between the brain and the mind in some way. Okay, so let me go page 10, 13 here. If we only knew it, God's most cherished secrets are hidden inside the human skull. Ecstasy, eternal love, grace, and mystery. Now, I'm certainly not wanting to deny that there are God faculties within the higher faculties of the human mind. So I'm not trying to deny that. What I'm trying to get at is, throughout the mystical literature of humanity, the fundamental experience of self in states of awakening or the fundamental experience of God is associated with the human heart. The deeper mind and self and origins of consciousness are connected to the heart. At least they were until Mr. Chopra came along. Now he assumes God's most cherished secrets are hidden inside the human skull. And what did he put up there? He puts ecstasy, eternal love. So is he saying that now the brain is the center of love? I mean, how many people go home to your sweethearts? Oh, no, you couldn't call your sweethearts now. You have to call my sweet minds.
Yes.
Your sweet mind. My dear sweet mind.
Sweet limbic.
Yeah. I'd go up to your sweet minds or sweethearts and tell them I love you with all my head. If someone came to me as a psychologist and said I love someone with all my head, I would definitely agree that he needed his head examined. People just have more common sense than Deepak Chopra. There's something kind of fundamentally mistaken to think that love is only something produced in the brain, in the head. And this is the same emphasis in what the bleep do we know, where I say they know nothing, because they also identify emotions and love with the midbrain structures. So it's like people think all the mind and consciousness, is everything is up in the head. And these people are trying to espouse a holographic or holistic model of the nature of a human being and the nature of the world. So if you're going to have a holistic model, why are you going to chop someone's head off and think that everything is just in the head and it controls the body like some little man in the head controlling a machine made of material matter? Like, it's a naive and simplistic view, which has been characteristic of modern thought for the past century, is this simplistic, dualistic mind-body idea. Okay, so now Deepak Chopra, he puts ecstasy into the brain's response to God. Again, ecstasy in the mystical literature has to do with the awakening of the and realization of the bliss sheath within the heart, identified as the size of a small grape, a mass of unemergent light within the deep physics of the human heart. And the experience of that self, the awakening to that experience, can fill one with a certain bliss and ecstasy, inner ecstasy of being. You see this state sometimes in babies before they're born. I think we live in this state when we're young. Babies sometimes, they can just be simply gleeful, as though they're just abiding and enjoying the kind of ecstasy of being. And it's as though their consciousness is still within the heart in that way. Adi Da, in his autobiography, has fascinating writings about how when he was a child, he experienced this all the time, and he had a special name for it. He called it the bright. Sorry, I've lost the tooth here, so words I had to say. The bright. Okay, so it was this kind of inner awareness of being, this kind of rapture and ecstasy of this self-experience within the heart. And Adi Da describes how in his life, as a child, he thought everyone experienced that. He couldn't understand how everyone was so grumpy and unhappy and fighting all the time around him. And through his life, in a way, he forgot the experience of that as he grew up and he was educated. And as you're educated, we pour things from outside a person into a person. We kind of fill them with ephemeral knowledge, and we call that education, much of it. So we kind of condition the mind through education, and the person's center of gravity of being, in a way, passes from the heart into the mind in the head. And that's the formation of false ego and false sense of self and who you are. Okay, so then the mysteries of the heart, well, the secrets of the heart are described as mysteries, because the mind, as Gibran in the Prophet says, the mind longs to know the mysteries of the heart. That's why mystics say that the truth is like under our noses all the time, because kind of under our nose is our heart. So in the mystical teachings, the deepest secrets of a human being have to do with the mysteries of the heart and not the famous cerebral cortex. Okay, here we'll move along another quotation here, page 25. See what we got here. So now we have the outline for the entire spiritual journey in our hands. The unfolding of God is a process made possible by the brain's ability to unfold its own potential. Well, okay, so first, the unfolding of God. What, our brains allow God to unfold? Isn't that kind of peculiar? God can unfold now because we have brains? It's God, the unfolding of God is a process made possible by the brain's ability to unfold its own potential. Like, how absurd is this? Our neurons have evolved to make these higher aspirations real. From the womb of the brain springs a new and useful God. From the womb of the brain springs a new and useful God. Hey, aren't you glad, Jim? God's got something to do. I remember that when, many years ago, Jim, 20 years ago, you worked at that group home with kind of retarded children.
Oh, yeah.
Tell that story of that fellow who used to, I won't say the phrase, I'll let you tell the story.
Oh,
we used to play with that so much. You remember the phrase?
Well, he just, it was just that he was in a behavioral program, and he was always uttering things he wasn't supposed to be uttering, so they were trying to condition him not to say these things. And one day I was supervising him and supposed to keep him in this chair where he's supposed to sit until he conform to the expectations, and all of a sudden he turned and he looked at me and he says, "Jim, don't you be mean to God."
Yeah, don't be mean to God.
Yeah.
I remember we used to play with that all the time. We'd say, "Oh, don't be mean to God."
Yeah, I think Deepak's being a bit mean to God. Because
I think he is.
I'm not sure how you get your womb in your brain, too. I mean, he's got everything else in there. I suppose if he's got room for God, he's got room for the womb, too. talk about mixing your metaphors.
It really is most peculiar.
It's very strange. I just wanted to say something about, you know, something that one of the earlier quotes that you made was when he was talking about ecstasy and love. Every process, I forget all the terms he used, but they all referred to emotional processes. And isn't it interesting that they all end up in this, what you call a head doctrine? People put all these processes above the neck into the brain, you know, and specifically into the cerebral cortex. But if he's trying to present a holistic view, what happened to the rest of the body, of course, is the first question. But also, the word ecstasy is derived from ecstasis, out of some sort of set, you know, regulatory pattern. So to be ecstatic is to be outside of yourself, is to be outside of the normal. And that would imply, well, my idea of ecstasy involves the entire body. It's not something happening in your brain. It's something that happens to your whole being. That's what ecstasy is.
Yeah. And well, it's like that standing out of negative existence into positive existence.
Yeah.
In Kabbalah, you might see it that way. It's like as I emerges out of the chaos, it declares I am, and it kind of comes forth in this ecstasy of being. Yeah. So, but here, then the whole process is imagined as somehow occurring within the brain and the mind. The next page, page 26, he says, a fully awakened brain is the secret to know God. Well, see, we're not even disagreeing that there are higher faculties of the mind which allow different experiences of different dimensions of God or of spiritual or divine being. We're not even arguing that, but it doesn't originate from within the heart, the mind. It originates from within the heart, and it's the light and pure existence which emerges out of the heart, which then can illuminate the mind. And if we open the heart, the mind can then be illuminated, and it opens up these higher faculties of the mind. But to think that the mind in the brain is the origin of the consciousness and the awareness of God is completely fanciful. And it completely contradicts the spiritual religion of all the worlds, of the spiritual literature of all the world's religions, from Judaism and Kabbalah to the Tibetan Buddhism to Madame Blavatsky's secret doctrine to Gurdjieff, everybody, except Krishnamurti, who was a very intellectually centered and seemed to center most on the mind in the head. But the esoteric teachings, Blavatsky says the heart doctrine is for the elite, whereas the head doctrine, or no, she calls it the eye doctrine, is for the multitude. Like you see the third eye and the idea of the Illuminati and the opening of the third eye. They kind of think that your higher self is the third eye in the brow chakra. So this is a kind of false teaching of the Illuminati. Really, in the deeper esoteric teaching, the teaching of the elite is the heart doctrine. That's how it's explained by Blavatsky in the secret doctrine. Okay, a couple more. Let's see. We might, 138, page 138. We'll flip along here. Okay. That's a bit. I'm going to leave that actually. Okay. Page 45. Let's try that one. The brain is the only way of registering reality. Okay, see here, think of that. The brain is our only way of registering reality. Well, the brain is part of the central nervous system, which includes the brain in the head, and then it includes the backbone, which is encased in bone, the spinal column, sorry. So that's called the central nervous system. But then the human being also has a wholly independent, separate, autonomic nervous system. Now, the bulk of the autonomic system is not in the head at all. It includes the solar plexus, just below the rib cage. That's where people feel anxiety and fear. You feel it in your solar plexus. It can make you feel sick to your stomach when you feel anxious. So we experience anxiety directly in the solar plexus. We can also feel things in our hearts. And there's a cardiac plexus. So that's part of the autonomic nervous system as well. If a person is very afraid, they lose control of the hypogastric plexus, which might cause them to urinate or defecate. So when people are threatened with death or under supreme fear, they'll defecate. So we experience directly in relationship to the autonomic nervous system. So there's not only the head and the brain, there's also an autonomic nervous system, which is very complex, and it's all spread through the body. And Gurdjieff describes it as the emotional brain. It's part of the emotional brain, along with the heart. And also, you look at all the words we have for the heart, recognizing it somehow to be the essence of a human being. Like if we speak from the heart, it means you speak like from your deeper self. You're not, when you speak from the heart, then you're speaking from your truth instead of speaking from the mind, which is deceiving, deceitful, to think about what to say. But if you speak from your heart, Native Americans said, don't trust a white man. He thinks with your head. Don't trust someone who doesn't live in the heart. Okay, so I've lost my line of thought here a bit, Jim. Can you save me?
I guess you were talking about the idea that there's this whole. He says that you register everything. Things are registered in the brain. That's our way of registering reality.
Oh yeah, only registering.
Registering.
In
and
the
again,
brain.
Again, it's yeah. It's the same. It's the recurring mistake where, it's a mistake that's common to almost all consciousness researchers today.
Yeah.
I've mentioned in previous programs that. In Susan Blackmore's book, she's a British psychologist, and she has a book called Conversations on Consciousness with all the leading researchers in consciousness in the world. And almost every person, I think there's 23 different people in that book, they all speak about consciousness as being in the brain, and it's almost as if human beings were just these head cases, that there was, as you say, it's like some sort of little brain up there running the rest of the body, and there's no kind of recognition that intelligence is in consciousness is distributed throughout the body, and then more so that it's centered not only in the head, in the brain, but also in the heart and in the spinal column.
Yeah.
It is related to blood flow. I mean, it's such a simplistic it's such an overly simplistic model of consciousness and awareness. But you don't even have to be a psychologist or a researcher to figure that out. All you've got to do is observe yourself, and you realize that our consciousness is spread throughout our body, and it's related to blood flow, and there's a million different things that people experience that contradict this idea. It's so simplistic, but people are in love with their brains, so that consciousness researchers think where is consciousness? Well, they think that it's in the place where you think, which is in the brain, but it's completely an illusion.
Yeah, that's what you're hinting at here also, is this notion that the people who think about consciousness use their minds to analyze consciousness. So then the mind thinks the mind is in the mind, which it is kind of. But it's like they're a way of approaching consciousness is not through what Gurdjieff would call direct self-study. It's thinking about it. They use the mind to think about and analyze consciousness. So when you use your mind, it focuses the consciousness more in your head brain, and then you think that consciousness, you think, is this minding activity. Whereas in the mystical tradition, what's called the monkeys of the mind or the turning of the mind, that's seen as an obstacle to higher consciousness. That's what we have to transcend, is that egoic minding activity that the scientists are considering to be your real nature, your real self. Okay, the other thing, just staying on this, where he says the brain is our only way of registering reality, I want to mention, firstly, the autonomic nervous system is a way we have of registering reality. And the other is the fact that the heart has its own electromagnetic system. And the electromagnetic volume of the heart is 5,000 times that of the mind in the head. This is made by point is comes out of the research of the Heart Math Institute, which recognized the primacy of the heart. So if we take a human being as a whole quantum system, which in quantum theory, if we want to apply quantum theory to a human being, which we should definitely be doing, it's the new way of conceiving what a human being is. We're quantum systems. We're composed of matters and energies. We're quantum systems. Okay, so if we take a human being as a whole quantum system, then the electromagnetic center of that quantum system is the human heart, with an electromagnetic volume 5,000 times the volume of the mind in the brain. So the heart is the sun of the body. It is the center of the microcosm, and the mind only reflects the nature of the self within the heart. And mystics compared these to the sun and the moon. The self in the heart is described as inherently self-illuminating, like the sun, whereas the mind in the head is compared to the moon. The moon has no light of its own, but it reflects the light of the sun. So the moon appears to be a light body, but really it's light reflected from the sun. Similarly, the mind in the head, I would say, doesn't produce the light. No, the light emerges out of the physics of the heart, and it illuminates the mind so we can be conscious in our mind and what's on our mind and conscious of perceptions and so on. So, you see, one of my works is entitled Microcosm, Macrocosm. And the idea is to try to look at a human being as a microcosm of the whole. But to do this, we have to realize the center of the human microcosm is the human heart, not the human mind. So from my perspective, this is a fundamental mistake that not only is in modern psychology and science philosophy everywhere. Carl Sagan told us back in 1980, he says the cerebral cortex is where consciousness is manufactured out of matter. But it was a completely imaginary, off-the-top-of-his-head idea. There's no evidence for it. Wilder Penfield, the famous Canadian physician who investigated the nature of the mind, he said the cerebral cortex, he says in 1936, we knew that the cerebral cortex could not possibly produce a phenomena that we label as mind. So he said in 1936, because he examined the brain, stimulating parts of the brain, he could never identify what the source or origin of mind was. So certainly the nature of consciousness and mind are very, very deep enigmas, and what I'm trying to stress is the importance to consider a human being as a whole quantum system. The heart is the center of that quantum system, and I'm saying we want to consider seriously that there is something like a spiritual self or an I of some kind within the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. Okay, so the heart, I say, is nothing like what we imagine it to be. And if we go back to the ancient Upanishads of India, one Upanishad says, the sun, the moon, the earth, all things in the outer world are within the lotus of the heart, within the cave of Brahman. So within the mystical literature, the fundamental experience of mystical unity is associated with the depths of the heart and the holographic nature of the heart, not the mind in the head. And lastly on this theme, Madame Blavatsky says, the mind is the great slayer of the real. Let the disciple slay the slayer. Okay, so anything more, Jim, to say just on, I don't mean to be mean to Mr. Chopra, and I'm sorry he's been mean to God. Poor Mr. God's got to be produced out of our cerebral cortex, our brain. Now he's got something to do.
I guess a couple of things, actually. One is that once you're made aware of this idea of a challenge to the idea that consciousness originates out of the head brain, out of our skulls, which, as you say, there's actually no evidence to support that. Carl Sagan says that on page 380 or whatever of Cosmos, and he says it in The Dragons of Eden, too. And most contemporary consciousness researchers assume that. But that's all it is. It's an assumption. And there's absolutely no scientific evidence to document that idea. But once you're made aware of it by being challenged by it, you read in the mystical literature, in your book, The Heart Doctrine, you survey a variety of mystical and esoteric teachings, and over again across cultures and different approaches, you see this idea that the heart that is the center of consciousness. I mean, it's, and that's where the self is centered. And you realize that this idea has existed for thousands and thousands of years across cultures and quite brilliant exposition.
It's remarkable. Yeah.
Yeah. And when you see it, you realize. I mean, I remember when you were working on your book at various points. Like I said to you, sort of enough is enough. Like you could kind of edit this book in the sense that you could take some of these quotes out because you made your point. But what I always find is that I still find other sources that you didn't quote that, that further this idea. It's just, it's unending, I mean, how many different teachings speak about this. And then when you see that, then you realize, listening to modern psychologists and scientists, whenever they talk about consciousness, how they just, they're all assuming the head doctrine. They're all assuming that consciousness is in the brain, that is produced in the brain. And then, from my own studies of the history of science, you realize that there's actually a very good reason as to how that, well, it's not a good reason, but there's a reason why that happened.
Like historically.
Historically,
yeah.
How consciousness was taken out of the universe, along with animism and purpose and intention.
And soul.
Another
concept that was dismissed like that.
Yeah, right? soul and spirit. Yeah. Everything was withdrawn from the universe, and really, when you get right down to it, it ends up that intelligence and awareness and consciousness end up in the cerebral cortex of human beings, and the people who promote that idea will laugh at mystics and talk about how they're full of self-aggrandizing statements about knowing themselves and the universe, but it turns out the scientists think that the smartest thing in the universe is human beings, and it's all up in their little cerebral cortex. It's actually quite absurd, and as I say, there's a reason for that, but none of this was proved. It was all done by assumption and fiat and caveat and just arbitrary methodological decisions. There's no scientific proof to disprove any of these things.
No, there's not. No.
And in fact, when you look at it from the mystical perspective, then you realize that not only is this not substantiated, but it's wrong. I would say that I firmly believe now, on the basis of 30 years of looking at this and studying this in terms of mystical teachings and in terms of your efforts to integrate it with modern science, I think it's quite clear that it's wrong.
Yeah. It's funny, like what you were getting at a bit earlier, I thought, is like as you begin to be challenged about it, you begin to see it everywhere. You begin to see that fundamental mistake being made everywhere. Like you referred to Blackmore's book. All these world expert consciousness researchers, none of them even conceive that consciousness might be produced in the heart. Is there any mention of the heart in the book that you can recall?
No. I think there might be... I can't really remember, actually. I think there's one or two people who talk about consciousness as not being restricted to the brain, but I can't remember.
Yeah.
But
well, that's important. That's really important, too.
Yeah, and it really stood out because it was so unusual in this book that somebody actually was, challenging that perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, a couple of years ago, Newsweek had that cover story about, are we hardwired to know God?
Oh, yeah.
And it was based on you read that book of those guys, those two guys who talked about...
Those neurotheologists.
Yeah, neurotheology.
Oh.
And
yeah, how the brain produces a God response.
Yeah, and I mean, this is what I think Chopra's on, is on that page too,
he is. Yeah.
And yet, nobody kind of wants to... to go beyond the idea that the heart's just a mechanical pump. I remember seeing a cardiac surgeon one night saying, "It's not the seat of the soul; it's a pump."
Have you ever heard the first time I was on Coast to Coast and I talked? I had that lady call in who was a nurse in the cardiac unit of California hospital.
No.
And what I was saying about the heart, and she called in and its paranormal aspect, and she called in and she did. Just said, that she had frequently experienced, people being out of their body around their heart transplant operations.
Oh, yeah.
And she just knew that, yes, the soul somehow is connected to the heart. I mean, this is an ancient idea. The heart is connected to the soul.
Yeah.
I mean, they go together, the heart and soul.
Yeah.
Yeah. But now it's funny, like someone like Chopra and then someone like Dean Radin, they kind of dismiss the ideas of the soul. Like both of them do that. Their attitude is kind of, well, the idea of the soul is kind of a superstitious thing that's arisen out of religious thought. Now we don't need that because we have science and we have the quantum brain.
Yeah,
that's their attitude.
Yeah, they're trying to be,
substitute it.
Yeah, they're being so scientific that, or what they think,
or
is
think
science,
they,
scientific.
Are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as you say, when you really look at it, I mean, you've used this phrase a few times in the past several weeks, and the more I think about it, the more I think this is really applicable. When you really look at modern psychology, it is a pseudoscience. I would say. It's so distorted in terms of its lack of understanding of the most basic question that faces it. What is the nature of human consciousness? That's what psychology should be about. And it went out of its way for 40 or 50 years to completely deny, you know, that the question even existed. And it never really addresses it in any kind of fundamentally sound way. And it certainly doesn't adopt the methodology of self-study, which the mystical and esoteric traditions do. And therefore, it looks for outside all the time and never really looks within, which is where you have to study it. You can't study consciousness. You can, in some ways, you can study consciousness outside of yourself, but you can't study it in its essence without studying yourself. It's just, it's just impossible. You know, I think
it's funny. I mean, that absolutely most fundamental basic thing about understanding consciousness has been completely ignored in modern psychology studies, from my experience. No one's ever talked about studying consciousness in yourself.
Yeah.
That's why they have all these wrong ideas about it, because no one's ever taken that time. But that's the opposite of yoga, of all the mystical traditions, like in jnana yoga, the yoga of knowledge. You go into the inquiry as to the nature of self, and you be aware of your thoughts, and you realize you're not your thoughts, and you're not your perceptions, and you're not your ever-changing emotions. You witness these things and realize, I am not that, I am not that. And you, through that method, inquire in your own inner experience into the nature of self. But psychologists have none of this direct self-study.
No, and I would say that my own feeling is that 30 years ago, when I first encountered the Fourth Way teaching and learned about the idea of trying to remember yourself, and I started to try to remember myself to see if it was true that my normal waking consciousness was normally could be likened to a waking sleep, a state of associative hypnotic existence. I realized that I try to wake up and I try to remember myself, to try to divide my attention so that there was a part of myself that was bearing witness to my thinking and feeling and acting. And I realized I couldn't do it. And I also realized that if I tried to do it, the more I tried to do it, the better I got at it, in a sense. But most of the time, I was indeed in this state of sleep, what Gurdjieff calls waking sleep. And that, to me, is like the most powerful, the most elegant psychological experiment ever devised. You know, I know of nothing in Western psychology. To me, that's real psychology.
To study yourself through self-remembering and being aware of your own consciousness.
And to try to remember yourself and to realize
be aware of yourself.
That you can't do this. I mean, it's an astonishing discovery. And then to realize that you know, you can't do it now, but that with practice that you can do it, and that the more you do it, that it changes. It fundamentally changes your understanding of the nature of consciousness. And I mean, that, you know, for the last 30 years, I've been trying to do this, you know, to practice this method. And I realized, that's why I say now more and more I come to kind of your view that really Western psychology is a pseudoscience. I just don't think it's grounded in the right.
I totally see it as a pseudoscience. I mean, you think that they began 100 years ago, they dismissed the idea of the soul purely on preferential basis, not on the basis of evidence. And they've only, in 100 years, they still only have this dualistic mind-brain model of psychology.
Yeah.
They have no understanding of the nature of the self, no understanding of consciousness. Most of psychological research is pouring from the empty into the void, as Gurdjieff would call it, with simple demonstrations of obvious truths. No one understands the basic structure of a human being, as a living being. Everyone's got all these little theories about all little bits, but no one has a basic understanding of the structure of a human being, like the structure of the different aspects to mind and what consciousness is. It's so lacking. It's incredible.
Yeah, and the more you know of it from an esoteric perspective, the more you realize that, you know, how lacking things are. It's like one of Gurdjieff's talks that he gave. He said, "Know thyself," and he began the lecture with those words, and he said this is generally attributed to Socrates, this term, but it actually is pre-Socratic in terms of it. It applies to a variety of different esoteric teachings and methods, and that it embodies a very rich content. But people today in modern times have a very poor understanding of what knowing self means. They think it means, they have a very superficial sense of it as to know your likes and your dislikes and your tendencies and your proclivities. But he says to really know yourself, you have to know the parts of the human machine, the human organism. You have to understand what they are, how they're connected, how they're correlated, and you have to observe them and to study them systematically in order to know the whole. Yeah. You have to know the parts and you have to know the whole. And in order to know something, you have to know everything. And that, I remember years ago, you used to begin your lectures by asking, what are the parts of your being? I was just thinking of this today, actually. As funny, or I was thinking of this earlier, you know. And I'm thinking, you know, like, that's a really great question. What are the parts of your being? And it's the one that really psychology has not really addressed in any satisfactory way, because it's kind of all on the wrong footing. It's all on the wrong foundation, you know. Like, well, what are your parts of your being? John Watson, who was the creator of behaviorism in the 1920s, said that the one of the parts of your being that went out with psychology was the soul, because John Watson said, and I quote, "Nobody has ever seen a soul in a test tube, so that's the end of the soul. You know, we don't need that." I mean, what a completely idiotic and ridiculous
pseudoscientific
assumption. Don't need that. It's that, that's associated with religion and mysticism, so we'll just toss that out, you know. And that's how science disproved the existence of the soul. Nobody ever saw one in the test tube.
Yeah.
Well, you know, like, I mean, it's just idiotic, you know.
But, and it's also interesting because it's like the behaviorists try to deny the existence of mind, even.
Yeah.
But it's such a peculiar paradox. What do they think they're using to deny the existence of what they're using? Like, they're using their mind to deny the existence of mind?
Yeah.
Like, it's so peculiar, extraordinary.
Yeah, and then when finally, in the 60s, when the mind and consciousness started to be reintroduced into psychology, that's when psychologists started thinking about what the mind was and what consciousness was, and they thought it was thinking. And essentially, it's the contents of the so-called stream of consciousness, which are the end products of the electrochemical processes of the neurons in the brain. That's what consciousness is. You know, Carl Sagan says in a couple of different places, he said in an interview, but he says it again in his Gifford lectures about when he's talking about the human mind. He says he's talking about human beings, and he says it's thinking, which was really distinctly human, that separates us from the other species. And you know, on one level, yeah, that's true, but it's not just thinking that distinguishes us from the other species. It's the nature of our consciousness that distinguishes us from the other species, and that's not just thinking. But that's the equation in modern science and psychology, is consciousness equals thinking.
And that unique aspect is the kind of development of the cortex.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an interesting, even the word man comes from manas from in Vedic. In India, and means mind. So even in the mystical literature, it's recognized that man as a being has the capacity for these higher faculties of mind, but that doesn't usurp the primacy of the self within the heart.
Yeah.
That's established. But man also then has these higher mind faculties that can be illuminated by the light of the self. So that I can see in ways the value of realizing the higher mental faculties of human beings, but that, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
were you going to give out
my, sorry, Jim?
I was just going to ask, were you going to give out those numbers in case somebody wants?
Yeah, why don't we open it up now? That's a good idea. Here, where are the numbers? Where did I put them? Okay, in the United States, if anyone would like to call in, 877-876-5227. In Canada, it's 888-810-8322. If anyone would like to call in, we'll just let you interrupt and we'll kind of hold what we're discussing and we'll just fit you in any questions or comments anyone might have. So you saw some of the other things. See, I put my letters on Guy Ritchie and Madonna and Kabbalah up on the site. Jim, did you see that?
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
I thought they're interesting letters. Those are letters of response to articles I'd seen on Contact Music, where they kind of say, oh, Guy Ritchie and Madonna, they're interested in Kabbalah, and they kind of poo-poo it as though, you know, it's a fad kind of, and people don't see it deeply. And, you know, I praise Madonna and Guy Ritchie for their interest, serious interest in Kabbalah. You know, people don't realize in these esoteric teachings, they think they're just religious or superstition. They don't realize these are very complex models of the nature of reality. People don't grasp that.
Yeah, like, one of the comments, too, I think, was it was sort of getting at the idea that she just wants to survive her death, so it's sort of a source of self-consolation.
Yeah,
for
comforting.
Her.
It's comforting
to
believe
that,
in God.
You know, as I told you before, I was reading Carl Sagan's book, The Varieties of Scientific Experience, which is his lectures he gave, the Gifford lectures at the University of Edinburgh in 1985, I believe, and he's talking, they're about natural theology, and he's talking about religion and science, and I've been rereading a lot of Sagan's work, and throughout his work, he consistently puts forward the view that, you know, that religion is essentially just, it's a consolation for people who don't want to face reality. It's comforting to believe in things that we want rather than the way they are. And, you know, to some extent, that's certainly true of a lot of religious teachings and a lot of people who are religious, but it's such an insult to religious teachings and to religious people, because there are a whole variety of people who are religious and who follow religious teachings that they're not exactly comforting. They're challenging. I mean, to live a religious life, I would think, is in the true sense of the word, is a very challenging thing. It's not to lose yourself in the illusions of what you want rather than the way things are. And certainly when you apply that to the mystical tradition, that's completely, you know, wrong. I mean, that's just not right at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's... In ways it can be comforting. In other ways, it's a hard path to climb and to attain spiritually, mystically. It's a hard path, the root of self, striving for self-perfection, Gurdjieff called it. I always loved that phrase.
Yeah.
He talked about, he says, how we have to attain real I. And so we have to strive towards our own self-perfection in terms of being. And Gurdjieff provides such a complex model of what that striving involved in terms of overcoming personal conditioning and attachments and identifications and awakening of the higher emotional center, awakening of the heart, attaining higher consciousness. So rather than just being simple, I mean, if you want something... Pablum. I mean, the new, many new age books and things, I would say, are pablum. Some of these down the rabbit hole and how to know God with your head And things. This is kind of the problem. These are the false teachings, and the real religions are much deeper.
I completely agree. I think that there are so many distortions of religious teachings in the new age, and complex ideas are reduced to simplistic aphorisms and self-comforting thoughts. Like the one that drives me crazy is that we create our own reality, and you know, there's a sense in which we do create our own the meaning of our own reality,
yeah.
But we don't create our own reality in the sense that people mean it. And, you know,
it's
kind of insulting to people who, you know, died in concentration camps or who live in abject poverty or, you know, who find themselves in horrific circumstances throughout the globe, you know, like some sort of, you know, new age airhead is telling them that, you know, who's sitting in their comfort of their very, luxurious home, telling these people that, oh, we create our own reality. Is like, you know.
Yeah, so your bad fortune is your own mistake for thinking negative thoughts. Right?
Yeah, it's an extension of
the
just world hypothesis.
So a little child born with AIDS and in poverty and violence, and you created your own reality.
That really annoys me. I find it quite fascistic thinking, you know. I think it's just really wrong. But
yeah, it's like what they used to call in social psychology, they called it the just world hypothesis.
Right. Yeah,
I remember that was being studied in psychology. The idea that kind of like whatever befalls you is kind of due to your own good or negative.
You brought it on yourself.
You kind of bring it on yourself, and that's a kind of comforting thought. It's a simplistic way of that people have of understanding the world.
Yeah, sometimes in New Age alternative health things, I see things that tend to suggest that people who get cancer somehow deserve it, you know. So that it's an indication of them some sort of personal failing on their part. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, like, I mean.
Or if they can't cure it themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
wrong.
Because you didn't believe strongly enough or you whatever. Yeah. Which may, in some sense, be true. If
it's
we
huge.
Had enough power, we might be able to heal ourselves. But that's beside the point.
Yeah, you're spiritually inept because you've got cancer.
Yeah, I've just got a copy of this new movie out called The Secret. Oprah Winfrey had a show on it this week, which I watched. And this is like The Big Secret, the movie. And I'll do a review of it next week. I don't know if you have any opportunity. But it's just another movie, although it has valuable elements in it, as does Chopra's book and these other works. I don't mean to be too hostile in my critiques.
Oh, I do.
But it's of the same genre in ways, making fundamental mistakes. Even though when I saw the fellow on Oprah, he was saying, like, I object to this idea that you create your own reality by your thoughts. So you just have to envision what you want and kind of put the thought out there. And usually the thought is people want material gain, prestige, relationships. Like, it's all in the domain of personal fulfillment in a way. Okay. But anyway, in the fellow on Oprah, like he says, he called it the threefoldness of it. And he said, well, it's not just your thoughts, but you also have to be aligned with your emotions. And you also have to, like, manifest physically.
Yeah.
So really, like, if you want to create your own reality, you can create it through your mind, your emotions, and your actions. So instead of just thinking your thoughts create your reality, see a human being as a threefold. You function mentally, emotionally, and physically. And we can create different aspects of our reality using all three of those aspects. It's not just we create our reality with our minds. Most of that's completely imaginary. It's interesting also, it's like how Gurdjieff says that, in Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, how disturbed the psyche became of those strange three-brained beings on planet Earth, that they began to take the ephemeral for the real, and they could see only unreality. And he explains how our true consciousness passes into the subconsciousness. So the consciousness of the heart kind of becomes in the background, in the subconscious. And instead, we have this false consciousness system, Gurdjieff labels it. And that's kind of conditioned into the mind. So much of this kind of New Age material, I think, just fosters this false consciousness system, but he's trying to tune it up a little bit, fine-tune the false consciousness system.
Yeah, well, it's,
make it better.
Yeah, well, I mean, and that's really what, in another sense, that's what modern psychology does too, eh? Like in therapy, is you try to replace one kind of conditioning with another kind of conditioning, a better conditioning, but, you know, there's not really the desire to really develop, you know, the develop real consciousness or real awareness of the true self. It's sort of on a horizontal rather than a vertical plane, you know.
Yeah, that's a good example. Like the psychologists would say, someone's been negatively conditioned, so what we got to do is turn around and positively condition them.
Yeah.
So it's kind of negative and positive conditioning, but the mystical path is learning how to be unconditioned.
Yeah. Well, you actually wrote that it yourself in a grant application years ago, and I always really liked that because I thought that's, you know, very good insight into things. That it really kind of characterizes the situation. You know, it's funny, you're returning just a minute to the Gurdjieff when you're talking about, you know, the whole struggle and the path to realize consciousness, and you know, he has his perspective on the soul is that we don't have a permanent soul, that we have to make one, you know, through our efforts, and that it's a very difficult and, you know, a very challenging task for people. It's part of the awakening process is to make permanent the soul. And there's a quote he has, which is that, blessed is he who hath a soul, blessed is he who hath not a soul, but woe unto he who is in the process of making a soul, you know, which is like the suffering, the conscious suffering that's involved in the making of the soul, which is, of course...
Yeah, the kind of friction, he would the friction, the effort.
Yeah.
Like, I like how Gurdjieff says, consciousness cannot evolve unconsciously.
Yeah.
Like, the evolution of a human being, the next stage of evolution is the evolution of consciousness, but the consciousness cannot evolve unconsciously. We have to make efforts to awaken consciousness. So this step in evolution, it won't just happen. It takes something on our side to attain our soul. That's how Gurdjieff would...
Yeah.
I love his story about the oak tree that... He told to Fritz Peters in Boyhood with Gurdjieff, a book, and Gurdjieff looks out the window and there's a big oak tree, and he asks the boy, Fritz Peters, how many nuts there are on the ground around the oak tree. And Fritz Peters says, oh, there's thousands of nuts there. And Gurdjieff says to him, well, how many of those nuts are going to become oak trees? And Fritz Peters kind of looks and says, well, I don't know, maybe just a handful. And then Gurdjieff says, yeah, maybe just a handful, maybe just one, maybe none. And he says, we must observe nature and understand things by using the example in nature. And he says, similarly, human beings, it's like we're all nuts.
Yeah.
And we could become oak trees, but how many of us go into becoming an oak tree, fulfilling our potential in self-realization? And that may be very, very few. And Gurdjieff explains in this story, he says, and what happens to the other nuts? Well, they kind of break down and they go back into the ground and they become fertilizer. So Gurdjieff says they become fertilizer for future man, future woman. So I think that's really useful. Like people think, oh, religious teachings, you know, it's comforting. Well, some religions are, but that's more on the exoteric side where religion becomes dogmas and such. Many esoteric teachings really stress that we need to strive to attain our soul, to awaken and to realize God, and that if we don't do this, we can lose certain possibilities for evolution and growth and change. It's not just assured that everybody lives happily ever after. So from that perspective, that's not very comforting. But Gurdjieff says you put nothing up in store in heaven during your life, and you'll have attained nothing. So in ways, there are ways in which religious mystical teachings aren't very promising for afterlife.
I would say that all esoteric teachings aren't comforting in the sense that they demand that you work and that the path is very hard and there's usually some sort of crisis. The idea of the dark night of the soul, you know, that mm-hmm. you have to go through, you have to break through to break yourself down to reconfigure, to, you know yourself on another level. And but what I was getting at earlier a bit was with exoteric religions. Even it's like lots of people who are religious and who are serious about their faith. I don't think that they're all just conditioned to believe that, you know, someday they're going to die and I'll dance with Jesus, you know, and in heaven. I mean, I think that's a very gross, caricature, oversimplification and a caricature of religious teachings, you know. I mean, I certainly don't have much patience with a lot of things that are said by people who cite religious authority for them because they're just ignoramuses, basically, in my mind. But the other side of it is that, you know, it's throwing the baby out with the bathwater to just dismiss all religious teachings because of all the abuses and all the awful things that have been done in the name of religion. Look what's being done in the name of democracy and freedom right now.
Yeah,
does that mean
really?
We should dismiss all democracy and freedom? No.
Wow.
You know, it just means that when human beings are involved, there's going to be lies and distortions, you know? It's who we are. It's the peculiar psyches of the three-brain beings of the planet Earth is that they can make a mess of pretty much everything, you know?
Yeah, well, the world situation is so horrendous. I like that old quote from Gurdjieff. Do we think the world is ruled by a group of conscious people? Where are they? Who are they? In fact, we see exactly the opposite.
Yeah. It's a gross thing.
See that in the life of contemporary man. Boy, I saw in the news over the internet today, Putin in Russia addressing the big assembly in Russia and saying that, talking about the lawlessness of the United States and such, eh? I was shocked to see that.
From him?
From Putin. Before this massive assembly of thousands, like they're in the Russian parliament.
This is Putin who's being accused of murdering people left, right, and center. Former KGB agent Putin is accusing the United States of lawlessness. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
I think that's what we all could describe as a pot calling the kettle black. I mean,
yeah.
Have you been reading about him lately? I mean, you know.
No, I hadn't.
There's all sorts of charges about what he's been doing in terms of, you know, talk about black operations. I mean, there's serious charges that the terrorist attacks by the Chechenian rebels were staged by the secret police in Russia.
I've heard that too.
To bring on repression. I mean, this isn't...
Just like the London train bombings,
This isn't a bunch of lunatics or outsiders. This is people in the press who have said this and who have ended up dead for saying it.
Yeah,
you know?
I heard of that one.
Yeah, it's very disturbing, actually. I guess... On some level, it's interesting you should say that, but on another level, it's kind of hilarious. You know, it's like, Bush yelling about terrorists. You know, like, I mean, I guess it's all in your perspective. You know, it's like, as to how you see these things. But
I remember guys in jail; they had a neat saying that I learned when I worked in the jails. One fellow said, "Whenever you point your finger at someone else, you have three fingers pointing back at yourself." So it's like what you see in someone else. You know, look at yourself and see if it's threefold in you.
I
see that's like the situation today, you know, and the kind of fight to fight terrorism is the terrorism. We thought we're the saviors, but now we're realizing in a way we're the terrorists. We're creating terror within our own society, and we've kind of been so misled about understanding all these things. It's absolutely incredible. It's like, reminds me of Gurdjieff talking about the mass hypnosis of humankind.
Yeah.
And I simply see how the mainstream media have just become media of propaganda and controlled by the same elements who perpetuate these other atrocities. It's really quite disgraceful. Well, you know, you wonder, like, what do these people sometimes, do they not look in their heart and say, wow, the American dream has turned into the American nightmare. In a way, it's a kind of nightmare scenario, this insanity of nations.
Yeah, I mean, on a whole other level, too, I've been, I was looking at some information about James Lovelock, who was the guy who originated the Gaia hypothesis, you know, that the Earth should be understood as a living organism, and I didn't realize that he was... he invented a device which was able to measure pesticides in all sorts of animals, and it was actually his research which formed the basis for Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring, you know, which was the first book to really point out the ecological crisis. And then he also was the one who detected the high levels of chlorofluorocarbons in the air from aerosol cans and sprays, and you know, led them to being banned. And he's very pessimistic about the whole global warming scenario. He thinks that it's beyond the tipping point, you know, and that he says, you know, humanity will survive, but he's talking about, you know, massive starvation and massive famines throughout the world, and
maybe migrations of people. And,
exactly. He says, you know, China won't be able to feed itself, and there'll be a migration of people into Siberia because there's a lot of land there, and of course it belongs to Russia, which will be interesting. But anyway, I was just thinking, like, you know, you think in those terms, and I still read people, you know, who talk about global warming. I mean, our Canadian Prime Minister 5 years ago said that it was a socialist, Kyoto was a socialist plot to redistribute wealth from the rich to the poor, and that there, you know, that the science was uncertain, and that the problem wasn't the levels of carbon dioxide. We need carbon dioxide to live, but it was pollution. And I'm thinking, this guy's Prime Minister? What a joke. We're all doomed. You know, I mean, and that's a level of intelligence of debate, you know, amongst people who are leading countries. I mean, this guy's the Prime Minister of Canada. He said this 5 years ago. Now he's an environmentalist because people have suddenly woken up to this. But it just shows you, you know, how on a whole other level there are all these huge processes happening that people ignore. What I was getting to is that really, you know, as much as the threat of terrorism is disturbing to us in the West, this is 1,000 times, you know, may take your number, 10,000 times more dangerous, global warming. You know, we've sort of stood by for the last 10 or 15 years and done nothing about it because, you know, we don't want to damage our economies, quote unquote. Which again is a lie too. But I mean, it just goes to show you how short-sighted and how so much propaganda exists to keep things the way they are so that the vested interest can you know, maintain control of things. And it's just very disturbing.
Yes, disheartening.
Very disheartening.
Disheartening. And you know, I sometimes like to think of our contemporary situation of humanity. It's like the book series, The Lord of the Rings.
Oh, yeah.
And book two of The Lord of the Rings was The Two Towers. And for me, that's like the World Trade Center. And the World Trade Center and the kind of forces of Moldor, the kind of dark forces have taken over the Earth. And you just see them everywhere around the world. And, you know, and I think there are like signs of hope at the same time. You know, there are people out there who are waking up and seeing like, wow, you know, this is serious. Like, we've lost control. You know, this isn't what America was meant to be. This isn't what democracy is. This isn't what the media was supposed to be. You know, we believe in free speech, not a media of propaganda. What's become of us as a nation, you know? And I see, you know, at the moment, you know, we got the U.S. forces taking this huge nuclear arsenal over to the Middle East to try to stir up something, you know? I don't think I've ever had such a sense of like a kind of impending doom of the human race unless people have a change of heart and change courses, you know. It reminds me of Uspensky talking about being in Russia in 1915 before the revolution. And remember, he talked about seeing a truck go by, and on the truck It was full of all these crutches. And he thought to himself, wow, you know, the war machine is in motion and nothing's going to stop it. And there are all those crutches for those men yet who have yet to lose their legs, get their legs blown off, and they're going to need those crutches. And yet the mechanicalness of mankind is nothing that can stop it.
Yeah, he says, I was going to bring that up too, because he says, you know, I thought of the legs that would be torn off, in, you know, for the soldiers from these different countries and these different cities in Paris and in Vienna and Prague. And he talks about all these different European cities, and he says, all of which are cities that I loved because they were so different and, you know, because they were so distinct, and yet they were all going to suffer the same fate, you know, that they were going to be involved in this impending. Well, I guess the war had already started at that point. Russia wasn't in it, but he said that these lorry loads of crutches for the legs that were not yet torn off just revealed all the lies and fine words with which people deceive themselves about the true state of affairs, you know, and the mechanicalness of things, you know.
Yeah.
And he said to Gurdjieff, and I guess when the revolution broke out in 1917, he said, you know, chaos was everywhere, and the Bolsheviks were fighting, you know, and it was a provisional government, and everything. It was a time of great upheaval, and the Tsar had been, you know, been knocked off. And he said, you know, to Gurdjieff, well, nothing could be done at a time like this. And Gurdjieff said, no, on the contrary, this is the times of mass hysteria like this are the most favorable for people who can, you know, remember themselves and go about their work and remember what's important and what isn't, you know. And I always remember that, too. Like, I mean, I'm appalled by by the current political situation, but I've been pretty much appalled by the political situation for the last 50 years, just sort of in me, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I go back to my childhood when I was 12 years old, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, wondering, like, you know, if the world was going to end. I mean, we came very close to nuclear war, you know, at that point. And I can remember asking my mother, who was a pretty smart person, if she thought there was going to be a nuclear war, and she said yes, you know. And I could see it in her face when she was trying to answer me whether she should be honest or not, you know. And I really believe both my parents felt there was going to be a nuclear war, you know, and that the planet was going to be destroyed. And you know, it's just gone from sort of bad to worse ever since. But the other side of it is kind of trying to, and this is the sense in which the making of reality does depend on each individual. It's like you have to kind of remember yourself, and you have to remember that this is the mass hysteria and the mass hypnosis with which everything happens, you know. As Gurdjieff says, everything happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, in order to do, you have to try not to let everything happen in your own life, you know, and that's sort of where you have to begin.
Begins,
you know,
with yourself, kind of.
Yeah, and it's like, and when you were saying earlier about the consciousness cannot evolve
unconsciously,
you know,
mechanically,
and then Gurdjieff says that, you know, it's like it begins with, like, everything else begins with a few isolated cells, you know, becoming conscious, and then becoming conscious together to form, you know, a group of cells, and then the group of cells becomes, like, you know, and body becomes tissue, and then, you know, like, that's basically how I think you have to think of these things in a way. Is that you have to speak out, but you have to remember the circumstances that are described in the popular media and in the popular understanding of things, even from scientists and from smart guys like Deepak Chopra on the bestseller list. You know, most people aren't really going to describe how things are really happening. You know, there's always going to be different levels of distortion of it all.
Yeah. So and I agree. Like, I think the dire situation of humankind, like, is coming together with this kind of new age, you know, the idea of, like, the hundredth monkey, or enough people awakening that there's kind of this more broad, massive shift in consciousness. Like, Gurdjieff talks about in the awakening of consciousness, sometimes people need shocks, things that kind of shock them out, wake them up, and force them out of their sleep state. And that's kind of, I mean, I hope as the situation unfolds, I hope people seeing what's going on the world stage. I mean, it's happening now. You know, this is happening. I mean, the news these days is very, very dramatic news from all different sources, from Senate hearings to different committees and different investigations and questioning of what is happening. But I think also that here is a time where we see the criticalness of this kind of mass shift of human consciousness. That we're kind of coming to these points that you know, it's upon us. You know, it's like the people who in around the world, in a way, we need to join together in our hearts and minds and try to help however we might in kind of resolve some of the insanity of this situation. Otherwise, we may be on the path down into this new world order and, you know, the genocides of peoples and kind of Orwellian society. I mean, I see that now. I see the potent. I mean, I already think in a way we're in an Orwellian society now. You know, the media of free speech is really a media of doublethink. It's become a ministry of propaganda. We get such distorted views of what's really unfolding and. I mean, that's why the internet and alternative programming is so important. But we, you know, we need the media to stand up to their role too and look at what they're doing and, you know, help humankind deal with this really very critical kind of times in the history of humanity. That's how I see it. You know, I never really believed much in that idea of the Mayan calendar ends at 2012, and that's and there's kind of nothing beyond that, which leaves it open. Like, what's going to happen between now and 2012? You know, is there going to be some dramatic change, or is life going to go on as usual? I really don't know. I mean, it's a fascinating time to be alive. I mean, you know, the news is fascinating these days. You know? Do you pursue any alternative news sources? I know you get the Star, Toronto Star, and sometimes read the New York Times. And
oh yeah, I mean, you know, I study the media. That's kind of I've been reading quite a bit about, you know, the history of the American media in the 20th century, and mm-hmm. You know, I mean, yeah, you know, I mean, it's hard because you read different things and, you know, certain magazines and periodicals that you think are somewhat more progressive or more open to, you know, alternative explanations of things. And then you realize that even those, this is my own feeling, that even those publications like the New York or the New York Review of Books are pretty progressive magazines. But, you know, they put in a certain spin on things all the time too, and they stop at certain ways. Like, I mean,
yeah.
You know, the problem is that so much is controlled by, you know, these huge corporations, which are, you know, really big pathological.
Yeah, editorial censorship. I mean, that's what it is, and propaganda.
It's not even editorial censorship. It's an assumptive framework about things, I think, that is in a lot of cases. I mean, certainly there is, you know, there's always a collection called the Uncensored News, where they bring out the most, you know, biggest censored stories of the year in the alternative press, and that's always interesting because then you have direct interference from large corporate interests who don't want, you know, you to read about different things. But there's a certain inertia of assumptions and wrong thinking about things, I think, that's so prevalent that it's hard to kind of get at the truth of a lot of things, you know. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, for instance, you know, and again, you know, I'm 57 years old, so, you know, I was in the first year of high school when John Kennedy was assassinated, and in my last year of high school, Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy were assassinated, and I don't really think that, you know, the truth of any of those events has really been told, you know.
I think that
supposedly in a free society, a society with a free press, you would think that there would be more real interest in what actually happened, you know.
Yeah.
And you see how distorted, you know, like a guy like Gerald Posner wrote a book about 10 years ago, Case Closed, about the Kennedy assassination, which he says, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald did it. And you see how this book was, you know, was greeted in the mainstream media and how it was pumped up and everything. And it's just not right. I mean, it's completely wrong.
Yeah, just,
you know,
another whitewash.
Oh, totally. You know, yeah. It's a source of disinformation. And you realize, you know.
Like the 9/11 omission report, they call it.
Yeah, well, David Ray Griffin calls it the 983-page lie or something.
Oh, is that what he calls it?
Yeah, he's got this thing.
Wow.
You know in that magazine I gave you, the Global.
Yeah, I read that. Wow.
He has like 100 lies in the, but he calls it, whatever number of pages it is, that's what he calls it. He calls it the 983-page lie. You know?
Really.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what you see. Like, I mean, something as simple, something as drastic as that, like the President of the United States is murdered, and you know, 45 years later, we don't really know what happened. You know,
yeah, it's
and,
so disgraceful, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's a complete disgrace.
It's
and then, you know, 9/11 happens, and you have this, like, all these questions about what's happening, and you have this crime scene, and the President of the United States and the Vice President, you know, don't want to testify. They refused to testify. It was only the families of the 9/11 victims who forced them to actually give statements, but they didn't testify under oath. Why didn't they?
Yeah, it's so incredible, eh?
Yeah.
It's like there's complete lawlessness.
Yeah,
that's
why,
how I see it. It's like complete lawlessness.
Why was the steel from the World Trade Center shipped away immediately after? It was a crime scene. Why was that allowed to happen? I mean, those are the kind of questions that, to me, I would like to know the answers to this. I would like to know where the American Air Force was through all this, you know?
Just so endless questions.
Well, I'd like to hear a definitive account of why this was allowed to happen, you know? I'm very dissatisfied with the explanations, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm just a person who wants, you know, who's suspicious of all the lies, you know? I mean, that doesn't make me concerned.
And, I mean, you see polls of Americans show, like, you're not uncommon in that.
No,
like,
the
masses of people,
one poll
said
that 50%, over 50% of New Yorkers don't believe the 9/11, the official story of 9/11, which I found shocking, actually. I was really surprised by that.
Yes,
And yet, you know, it's the greatest mass murder in the history of the United States, and you know, we're told to just forget it, you know, that it's all been taken care of. I mean, you know, and of course, this is a justification for a war and everything. I mean, it's just like the lies build up on top of the lies, eh?
Yeah.
I read this great quote today in this book. It was by Hannah Arendt, who is a journalist who covered the Eichmann trial, and she's famous for the phrase, like, the banality of evil, when she covered Eichmann. She said, you know, that he was just this little man, you know, he wasn't this monster, you know, he was just this little man who was like, who revealed the banality of evil. And she had this quote to the effect that basically was saying that in order for a totalitarian state to arise, you have to keep telling people these lies, which build and build upon one another, and which soothe people, and it was kind of reminding me of your thing about the sheep, and you know, serve as a bomb so that they won't ask any questions, and eventually they'll be so satisfied with the lies that they'll just, you know, that they'll just sink into it, and then they'll be easier to control, and then there'll be a totalitarian state. And I see that in the way that people don't question anything, you know. I mean, my brother used to wear a button in the 60s that said question authority, you know, which I thought was always pretty cool. But we should question authority. I mean, that, you know, question all authority. Question the authority of science. Question the authority of religion. Question the authority of your government, you know. I mean, that doesn't mean that they're not telling the truth sometimes. Sometimes they are. But everybody lies, you know. I mean, it's that simple. And everybody lies for their own self-interest. And
as you say, I mean, everything is built up on so many levels of lie.
There's just this incredible tissue of lies that really, you know, that you need a machete to cut through it all, because it's just like it, and they reinforce one another, you know, and people have all kinds of wrong ideas about things. And we've seen, you know, as psychologists in the science of psychology, we've seen, you know, all these incredible lies, and this is supposed to be the science of psychology, which is really like just a pseudoscience.
Yeah, well.
Other than that, things are great. Well, on the other hand, you know, like, I mean, I think I was telling you the other day, I've been reading some books on the history of mysticism, and Evelyn Underhill, who wrote one of the great classics, Mysticism. I was reading another one of her books, The Essentials of Mysticism, and she was talking about the consistency across all these different great mystics, how the process of the mystical path can be likened to a threefold path, where you have a process of purification, and then illumination, and then union. And she was going through all these different great mystics, and it was amazing, like, how they all spoke in the same terms, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, you have to, first of all, you have to kind of recognize the pathology of the normal waking state, and you have to start to work to undo it. And then you start to see, and when you start to see, everything is imbued with this new meaning. And that's the way, kind of, like, you do make your own reality, because you start to see that, you know, you can't change the external world, but you can change the meaning of it. And then with that comes light, right? And with the light, eventually you reach a higher state, and then eventually, if you know, you fulfill the mystic path, you realize actual union with God, or whatever the term you want to use for the one, which is nothing.
Different states of union that the person might achieve.
Yeah.
On different levels. Like, I think we might achieve a union on a lower level, of samadhi, or then the highest levels of samadhi and realization.
Yeah, and that's that's an interesting point too, because I was reading this in terms of realizing God, but as one of the books I was reading pointed out, you know, there are different realizations where it's not necessarily, people don't say it's with God, but they realize, like, higher realms or realities, and you know, they achieve a state of union, but it's not like ultimate union. There's all sorts of intermediate states and stages or levels of higher dimensions and higher realities.
Yeah, people kind of see things sometimes like enlightenment. They think it's like a unitary phenomena, like you're either kind of asleep or you're enlightened, and it's completely unlike that. Like, there's all kind of levels of awakening and realization, no one kind of just attains enlightenment, and then from there on in, you're enlightened.
Yeah.
You know, we fall back down, we lose those experiences, we can't remember it, we strive to get back to it. I remember Richard Buck in the Cosmic Consciousness book.
Yeah.
He had one experience of cosmic consciousness in his life, and he wrote, it led him to write the book on cosmic consciousness, but he kind of laments, like, I was never able to kind of regain that experience of what I knew in that day. But he says in that day he kind of realized more than he had ever learned in all the books could possibly teach him. He had learned it directly through his experience. But afterwards, my point was the idea of enlightenment. There are levels and stages, and it's not a unitary thing. And people even have experiences of other realities. Well, there are a lot of other realities that you might experience.
Yeah.
It's not, you can't expect it all to be of one unitary nature. Not everybody's going to kind of see angels and go to heaven and encounter Jesus.
Yeah.
Some people might.
Yeah.
But other people will have different mystical or spiritual experiences of different spiritual beings or different realms or lower realms. I mean, I believe in the existence of these lower realms where we have a lot of lower souls kind of purgatory.
Well, I think there's quite a lot of evidence for that, actually.
Yeah,
in terms
there is.
Of read of people's experiences, I think that, I knew guys who were traveling in Africa who smoked some sort of drug with these guys, and they went into these lower worlds and said it was quite hellish, really unforgettable. What you were saying, I mean, Gurdjieff talks about that, about, you know, even for somebody who awakens from the, you know, he says there's the two lower levels of consciousness are sleep and normal waking consciousness, which he calls relative consciousness. And the idea is through remembering yourself and working to wake up is to realize the state of what he calls self-consciousness, which he says is the natural right of human beings.
Yeah.
But he said even those who attain self-consciousness can lose it, you know, and can fall back into normal consciousness. There's nothing like fixed or permanent about it. You can crystallize it on a certain level, but you can still always relapse into a lower order of consciousness. And then,
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and then the other side of it is like what you described, like with Buck. I remember reading, and Aldous Huxley has this really great piece, what he's talking about, light and the mystic experience, and he's talking about different people's spontaneous experiences of you know, being enlightened or illuminated. And one woman that he described, she was making tea. She was a girl, 13 or 14. She was making tea, and suddenly her whole kitchen was flooded with light, like with this incredible light, and she felt herself, you know, feeling kind of unified with this light, but she felt in this light like this intelligence, and it gave her this feeling of the essential, what she called the essential all rightness of everything, you know, which is Huxley says is very common in these experiences of illumination.
Yeah.
And she said she never had another experience like that again in her life, but what it taught her was sort of the essential all rightness of everything, and also that she no longer feared death. That she just lost her fear of death. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, that's pretty good light. If you know, it can make you feel that sort of the essential all rightness of the universe and make you lose your fear of death. And she only had this one experience, but it was so profound that it altered her whole conception of who she was and what her life could be.
Yeah, altered, transformed her life.
Yeah,
in
this one experience, you know. And it just happened. She was, you know, standing in her kitchen.
You see that also in people's accounts of near-death experiences.
Yeah,
Where people, they can't go down the tunnel into a realm of light and encounter spiritual beings, or they review aspects of their life and they come back and the most important thing they realize is love.
Yeah.
And no one comes back and saying, you know, I realize that I don't have enough property or that I got to have more money or something. I've never heard that. I came back and I decided I got to create more wealth for myself. Have you ever heard that?
That's pretty funny. Yeah, I had an experience of God, and he told me to sell more cars.
I had to build up my whatever.
Yeah, it was like, yes, that's so funny. It's like, well, last night was the 40th anniversary of the Beatles' first appearance on the 40th? No, it can't be the 40th. That would be the 44th? It was February of 1963. Yeah, and Ed Sullivan, because it was David Letterman, they had this band who was doing Beatles songs, but it reminded me, you know, it's like, all you need is love. Like, that's the other thing from my, you know, time, like, right after the Cuban Missile Crisis, is here are these guys saying, all you need is love. And in a way, like, I think I've had experiences of illumination in my life, but I think a few years ago, in very quick succession, this will sound kind of strange, but my father and my cat died, you know, and both of whom I loved a great deal. And I realized kind of in meditating and contemplating that I sort of came to the conviction that really what endures is love, you know, that love endures. I don't know how to say it in any kind of more detailed way than that, but, and I kind of, I knew it with my head, but I also felt it in my heart that love endures, you know, and that the more you can love, the more that creates something permanent and something that lasts, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It like it opens the vault of your heart.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If we think of that, it's like mystics. I know in the mystical literature on love, like so often in common life, everybody thinks, you know, you love someone. And you can't love one person, but that means it's exclusive, kind of.
Yeah.
You know, you don't love other people. You love one person, and you. But really, in mystical love, it's like there's an impartiality about it. It's like in mystical states, you feel your humanness with all humankind. Like, I feel in ways, I feel, you know, all the children of the world are my children.
Oh.
You know, I would strive to try to protect and serve all children of the world, like, because we're one human family, not just my kids, but like all people, you know, all women of the world. You know, they're all part of the human family, and we, you know, it's like the heart opens it and it can embrace the world in a certain way, you know, rather than a lot of people. The mind always differentiates and distinguishes things, whereas the heart unifies them.
Oh, that's very good. Yeah, I like
yeah,
that.
The mind is what sees, oh, this person's that color or that ethnic group or that religion and how I'm better than that or whatever, whatever, whatever. All the gobbledygook the mind has. Whereas the heart is open and embraces the whole, whereas the mind differentiates and fractionates and draws differences and such. Also, what you were saying a moment ago about like experiences of self-consciousness and then losing it. Gurdjieff has a very valuable system where he explains seven levels of evolution of a human being. And the first, he says, are common in ordinary life. Man number 1, 2, and 3, according to whether a person is most physically, emotionally, or mentally developed and centered. But then he says the next real level of awakening is the level number 4, which is the level of the heart chakra, the fourth chakra. He says a man number 4 is someone who's developed mentally, emotionally, and physically, like all three aspects of their lower nature. And at the same time, they get glimpses of this state of self-consciousness. And he says a man number 4 has glimpses of that state, but he still has to strive to maintain and deepen that awareness. But then for Gurdjieff, a man number 5 is someone who that state is then permanent in him. He doesn't fall down again in terms of losing that self-awareness. But that's permanent. He's attained permanent I, and it's permanent in him. Not that he's always in that expanded state, but it's always there. It's permanent in him. And that's a man number 5. And then the man number 6 and 7 for Gurdjieff is someone who opens the higher centers and experiences different levels of objective consciousness. But I just thought that idea of attaining that level where that is becomes stable in you. Jim, I need to attend something. Could you carry the line for a few minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, whatever you might want to pick up on.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
Well, on the topic of Gurdjieff and higher man number 4 and 5, my own feeling is that Gurdjieff represented some sort of higher man, that there was some sort of permanent principle in him. In a book I've written called An Alien Intelligence, I talk about Gurdjieff as being an alien intelligence in the sense that he's a being whose level of being was manifested in such ways that he was incompatible with what we understand a human being to be. And I don't think anybody's ever really come to terms with who he was or what he was, because most people who have written about him, who especially his biographers, have tried to, I think, normalize him and to try to have kind of seized on his external behavior, which was often quite bizarre and quite peculiar, and taken it as they've been caught up in his acting. Gurdjieff said that he was a conscious actor, and many people who worked very closely with him always said that was the impression he gave, that he was acting and that there was something going on that they didn't understand and that he was doing things for effects and for purposes that they didn't understand. And so often he would behave in ways which were quite bizarre and really not explicable in ordinary terms. And I think a lot of people who have written about him, especially as biographers, have kind of been caught up with the idea of his acting and haven't really gone beyond it to understand, well, what does it mean to be a conscious actor? And I believe that to be a conscious actor means that you have to be a conscious being, and that that means that in some sense he had some sort of a permanent principle in himself, that he was not a normal normal man. I'm losing my voice here. This is not good.
Gemma, were you mentioning Daly King's quotation?
Oh, I hadn't come to that, but
That captures that perfectly, eh? Where he says, like, Gurdjieff made him feel like he was a person whose every thought, feeling, and action was kind of done with awareness
and harmony.
That
he gave the indubitable impression that everyone else was out of step, but not this man himself.
Yeah.
And Daly King was not, he knew Gurdjieff, but he didn't study with him, and he had some sort of resistance to studying with him. But that's a great quote because it's from somebody who wasn't really like even, you know, an acolyte of his. He wasn't one of his pupils. He knew him, but he never committed to him, which is it makes it even more impressive. But what I was talking about was his conscious acting and this idea that what a conscious actor is somebody who has to have within them some sort of permanent principle, some sort of higher level of being, because to act consciously, you have to be conscious. And what I was going to get to was that this is in terms of, you know, Gurdjieff always disguised himself so well.
Excuse me.
And so people around him said, we never really saw him, you know, and he always sort of cast doubt on himself. Which was upsetting to people at times, but it was part of his method, was to put people off balance all the time. But there's a story that I just want to read. As Georgette LeBlanc was one of his pupils. She tells a story that when she went to visit him at his apartment, and he says he opened the door himself. The light coming from the little salon shone on him brightly. Instead of concealing himself, he abruptly stepped back and leaned against the wall. For the first time, he allowed me to see what he really was, as if he had suddenly stripped away the masks behind which it was his duty to hide. His face was imprinted with a charity that embraced the entire world. Standing rigidly before him, I saw him with all my strength, and I experienced a gratitude so deep, so painful, that he felt the need to quiet me. With an unforgettable look, he uttered, "God helps me."
Wow.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I've read tons of things about Gurdjieff and pretty much everything, I think, in English, and I think that's one of the few stories I've ever read where somebody really was allowed the privilege of really seeing him without his mask, and when you were talking about that feeling of love for everyone, that it's not restricted, you know, and divided, but, you know, at times I feel myself, I feel that impulse, and then I realize how that impulse can kind of arise in me, but it's suppressed because, you know, all my identifications and all my little eyes and all the fractionated aspects of my being come in and suppress it, you know, but at times I can feel it myself, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And so I try to cultivate it, of course, but I realize, like, it's there. I think it's there in all of us, but there's so much grime kind of covering it and so much encrusting, you know, that you have to break through to experience it. It's very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had quite a few experiences of that through the years at different times, of those feelings of where your heart feels so open and it can feel as though, well, that you're just in, there's a blissfulness even in it. There can be a blissfulness in it, and it's like you love everybody. It's just like love is everywhere. You just, it's filled with it. It's within everything. And also that feeling of everything is okay, just as it is. Like, I know I've had that experience. Like, on one level, you know, I feel distraught about the world situation, and you know, I want to try to help in however I might be able to in my little way in that. But in another way, like, everything is okay. Like, there's something so much deeper than myself and beyond us being played out here. And we're just these kind of characters in this kind of grand cosmic mystery story. Like, sometimes I think, you know, you can have a Hollywood movie, eh? And you can have these kind of big, intricate plots, the kind of things going on behind the scenes and that. Well, think, what Hollywood movie shines any light to what the true situation of what is unfolding on the world stage now? nothing in Hollywood. It makes it look puny, totally puny. The only thing comparable is Lord of the Rings, you know, kind of grand war of the forces of light and dark, you know, and threatening the world. But otherwise, like, you just look at what's really happened in the life of humankind, and you have, like, wow, God's written a pretty dramatic mystery story, adventure story, beyond anything conceivable in Hollywood. Anyway, these days we need holy world stars instead of Hollywood stars. We need people to shine forth in their truth in whatever capacity they have to kind of deal with the situation of humankind. We need holy world stars. You know, with too much tinsel. We need to get back to certain, you know, we want the American dream, not the American nightmare. You know, I don't want for future generations to live in an Orwellian society of implants and, you know, inoculations and mass control. It's terrible.
To me, it's like, you know, you don't need that. You got television, you know. You don't need to inoculate or implant anybody. You got television, you got newspapers, you got radio, you got the internet, you know. The sources of disinformation are so prevalent, you know. I mean, but yeah. as you say, like, people are so caught up in titillation and, you know, just this constant, you know, stream of mental masturbation that, you know, makes everybody feel good for momentarily, you know. It's like what Gurdjieff says is that the three-brain beings are experts in self-calming pleasuring, you know. And for this self-calming, they've developed various things such as cocainism, onanism, which is masturbation. You know,
alcoholism,
all of things which
endism.
And he was writing that, you know, like, I mean, that was 50 years, 60 years ago, and it's basically exactly the same situation, only worse. I mean, I often think at times, like, what would Gurdjieff make of the current situation? It would be, I think he'd be quite amused and at the same time horrified by it all, you know?
Yeah, he would.
It's just the
same old story, but it's like it's on a higher level now.
Yeah, well, as I say, well, you know, if we live in the information age, you know, we live in a universe where we're becoming more and more aware that, you know, about the importance of information on all levels. I mean, we also live in the disinformation universe.
Yeah.
You know, there's just so much lying going on out there. It's just unbelievable, you know.
It's like, I like that story. You may remember some details of this from Gurdjieff again. He tells the story of the black magician who owns a bunch of sheep. And these sheep keep wandering and getting eaten by wolves. Is that how it goes?
Yeah, and they run away.
And he wants them to kind of stay in their compound, So he persuades them that he doesn't really want to kill them.
He hypnotizes them,
yeah. Okay, and persuades them he doesn't really want to kill them. He's really protecting them.
Yeah.
And that they're not really just sheep. They're already magicians. And
lions and, you know, different things, eh? But they're not sheep. And that nothing bad will happen to them, at least not today.
So then in the end, I guess he doesn't have to build fences.
He doesn't have to hold them in because they just stand around waiting to be slaughtered. And he says this is a very good illustration of the position of contemporary humanity.
Yeah.
I mean, he was talking about it in terms of the level of the soul, but to me, you know, it's descriptive of our situation, I think, on a whole variety of levels. You know, it's like the nightmare parable, from the
Christian Gnostic Gospels.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I see unfolding on the world stage. It's like this nightmare parable. That's why I say, we want the American dream, not the American nightmare.
Nightmare, yeah.
You know, the dream kind of turned into this nightmare.
Yeah.
It's all very interesting.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's, at least the one sense I have sometimes is, wow, what a cosmic mystery story. And it's unfolding, and it's unfolding now, and you know, things are afoot around the planet, and, you know, and I think it's good to pray sometimes, put our prayers out there, and all people who want truth and light and love and believe in these things in the world instead of simply money, sex, and power, you know, at some point, you know, sometimes all the scum can rise to the top,
yeah.
You know, and it's like the waters of life, and there's seven levels of scum to it. So we got to kind of skim some of the scum off the waters of life. Otherwise, you know, it's like the quality of life of people is being undermined. You know, the American middle class, working people. You know, so many sectors of our life, and not just in the problems in the States. It's same around the world. There's got to be a new kind of consciousness somehow that we deal with these criminal elements within all our societies. You know, there has to be a change of heart somehow, and you know, it's a shame all these people in ways complicit in it who don't want to be.
Yeah.
You know, in a way, sometimes they're sheep and they're goats. Sheep are kind of led along and deceived. Goats are kind of part of it, but they don't want to be, but they're kind of like hard to get out of it, and you're kind of ensnared in your positions, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what they say of Satan, has a hierarchy of servants.
Judas goats.
Which?
Judas goats.
Judas goats?
You know what a Judas goat is?
No.
Well, in the slaughterhouses, goats will, the sheep will follow the goat to the slaughter.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, will they?
Yeah, they call it the Judas goat, you know.
Oh, yeah, that's very interesting. I was always worried. What was that story George Bush was reading when 9/11 happened?
Oh,
that was about a goat.
Somebody a goat? Yeah, exactly. Cheney the goat.
Anyway, I'm probably about a sacrificial goat. So
yeah, no, it's Cheney the goat. Maybe not. Yeah.
Okay, is someone coming in? No.
I think we're about done.
Okay, I think we got a few minutes. I'm not exactly sure. Don usually gives asks the word. Anyway, so... I'll just mention again, I'm going to be on Coast to Coast AM across around the world this Tuesday evening. Christopher Holmes, you can go to the Coast to Coast site and see some of the materials I have up there. I encourage people to visit my website at www.zeropoint.ca. Encourage people should buy my books. Nobody buys my books. They're profound books. They're collector's items. If you'd like your book signed, just mention it. And these are valuable, valuable books. And I hope in the next years that I'll find a major publisher who kind of recognizes the value of this work and makes it more widely available. I'd like to thank James Moffat. Thanks, Jim, once again.
Yeah.
It's amazing how we just trip along there and the time flies by sometimes.
Yeah, we should thank Doug and Don, too. And, you know, last week, the last time we were on, Don tried to phone you, but then he ended up phoning me. And he was just, like, so complimentary and so supportive. And he's such an interesting guy. And they've been really good to us. And,
for sure.
They provide a very valuable service. I really, really like BBS. And thank God for BBS and for other services like this on the internet that do provide an alternative to you know, so much of the other stuff that's out there, you know.
Yeah, it's like what Alex Jones calls information wars.
Yeah,
you know, like people need to learn, like need to wake up and kind of see what's happening in the world.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know if. Anyway, then maybe we should just sign out. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Any final thoughts, Jim?
All you need is love.
All you need is love.
I used to.